Wow. Okay, here we go. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the weekly podcast champion, not only of small L libertarianism, but small R republicanism as well. I am Matt Welch, joined, as is customary with our unwritten traditions, by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Greetings, subjects.
Hello.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Hi, everyone. Okay, as perhaps only Amazonian aboriginals are unaware of by now, Queen Elizabeth II died last Thursday at the ripe old age of 96 after 70 years on the throne, the longest reign in British history, one of the longest in world history, as a matter of fact. As bizarre as it sounds to say out loud, King Charles is now in charge of the constitutional monarchy. Being an American-based political and cultural publication with a healthy skepticism towards centralized power, Reason has not exactly stuffed its digital pages with Queen is Dead content. But I thought we might zip around the table real quick and each share a thought or two about the old gal or the monarchy and or the discourse around it. Catherine, your people, by which I mean Romanians, not the robots, absolutely adored the Queen. I think it's because she at some point hid in the bushes to avoid meeting Nicolae Ceaușescu, which is super awesome. What is one Mangu takeaway from the events over the last 4 or 5 days?
My takeaway actually is less in the Romanian heritage category or in the robots category and more in the high fantasy tropes category. So I obviously have been watching House of the Dragon and really feeling the gap between the modern royalty and the fantasy hijinks of the Targaryens and feeling worried about an impending convergence between those two things. So we published a piece by Robert Jackman, who is one of our freelance Brits that we keep around, doing a little bit of analysis of the Queen. And basically, the headline was something like, if monarchy is a must, keep it neutral. Basically, stay out of politics. This is good advice. This is not advice that people are good at following in general. And I would suspect that royals might struggle with it more than most. I am, I guess, just humbly submitting a plea to stop somewhere short of Targaryen-esque behavior to the British monarchy as it is now constituted. But I am only moderately optimistic that that plea will be heeded.
That's just not, it's not old Charles's go-to, at least in the first 73 years of his life. Nick, is your half-Irish blood more aligned with the Johnny Rotten of 1977 or the John Lydon of 2022?
Yeah, alas, with the earlier iteration of Johnny Rotten than Johnny Lydon. When I heard that the Queen died, the first thing I did was go to Twitter to see what the Sex Pistols Twitter account had to say, what Glenn Matlock, what Steve Jones, and what Johnny Lydon had to say, or John Lydon. And interestingly, the Sex Pistols have not acknowledged the death of the Queen. Steve Jones merely said, "What do you think?" And Glenn Matlock made a joke about King Charles, hoping that he's not some silly old thing. But John Lydon actually said, rest in peace and sent her off in high fashion. So, you know, if nothing else, it shows that age mellows even the harshest of monarchical critics. I'm still a Cromwellian. I think the king should never have come back from being beheaded in the middle of the 17th century.
Peter, one line of argument that I've read quite a bit over the last couple of days, Andrew Sullivan, In Between Tears, made a pretty good case for this. Another writer who...
So you mean it was just another week for Andrew Sullivan.
Ian Leslie, who writes really good about music, had an essay that was along this with that. Basically, sure, this institution is totally irrational, kind of embarrassing. It's nationalistic, but so are people. Damn it. And so therefore, this is a harmless and maybe even kind of useful or socially beneficial vessel to have so people can just put their weird irrationalities pre-Enlightenment irrationalities and nationalisms into this weird castle over there. What say you?
So I don't care for the monarchy, right? That's not, my preferred system of government. But I will say that the Queen... comported herself with a kind of honorability that is relatively rare in leadership, whether it's political or otherwise, right? She was stridently apolitical and went out of her way to be, which I realize is kind of a non sequitur for a monarch. But I think the best way to understand it is that she declined to make the institution serve some sort of personal political agenda. This was not about her advancing some sort of cause, right? Instead, what she did was she devoted her life to serving the institution. And while, again, I'm not in favor of monarchy, that is, it turns out, a pretty good way to build trust and credibility for a legacy institution. And I think it's a lesson that there are a lot of today's leaders, again, not just in government, could learn, that there is a public trust and goodwill to be gained from staying out of politics and from deciding we are not going to weigh into every single debate of the moment and decide to make this all about either me or my agenda. And so whether or not that's harmless, I think, I don't know if that's what I would, if I would use the word harmless, or if I would say that all, you know, it's all just in good fun, or that there's, you know, value there. But I would say that the way that she went about it in particular allowed that to happen. I do not expect that to continue to be the case. I think that King Charles is going to be much more political, and that we are going to see what happens when institutions are maybe not abused, but certainly used for personal political purposes, and it's going to be much worse.
Catherine, I did not have on the bingo card of reason staffers doing the, well, actually, monarchy isn't so bad. I didn't have J.D. Tuchilli on that bingo card,
yeah.
So color me surprised today. Over the last 4 or 5 days, Catherine, have there been other closet royalists who have outed themselves, and will you be either cutting off their heads or just engaging in some light defenestration?
You know, I do like a decapitation as a mode of execution, and Charles I, of course.
It's very honest.
You know,
very honest.
Already bringing some decapitative energy to the royal name.
Also, Sean Bean in the first House of Cards.
Yes, again,
the first Game of Thrones.
The first House. Wow, you said it. We, you know what? It's a little bit of both. So yeah, I'm pro decapitation. I don't mind a little light defenestrating, but if other royalists do emerge from our ranks and they are not Jerry Tuchilli, who I know for sure I could not take in a fight, then we will see how it goes.
Come on, he's tiny.
Wily.
You just shoot him from behind.
Wily and I would say wily. He is. Yeah. I would not fuck with Tuchilli.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's a dirty fighter too. He's,
can you imagine
from the streets,
booby traps on his property? Just
I have
like
imagined them.
Matt, has Mel Gibson weighed in yet?
Oh, that's
speaking of defenestrations, he has a defenestration scene in Braveheart.
That's true. I think I talked about it here. It's a movie I finally watched about a year ago. And holy cow, that
so
dude's got some problems.
So sometime next year, you'll do it as your recommendation?
I think so. And I don't want to spoil the party, but I saw all kinds of movies for the first time over the last couple of days. Nick, Catherine was just remarking as we were going in between some technical issues that perhaps the Queen with her, you know, she was there 2 days before death, welcoming a new prime minister, her 15th and final one. Perhaps the Queen is just showing that there is intrinsically a stronger work ethic among baby boomers than there are among Catherine and Peter's generation.
She's the greatest generation,
yeah.
Right? Because she's born in 1926. Yeah. She's a year older than I guess my mother would have been had she managed to live on as long as she did. So, yeah, you know, that, I mean, there's no question that Queen Elizabeth seems like a good person. And I know my parents talked about this during World War II when she was a teenager or whatever. And she and her sister would kind of walk through the London Underground and stuff like that during, you know, the Blitz and stuff. It, you know, she was an actually generally good figure throughout, and that's all great. That has nothing to do with politics, and it has nothing to do with the world we live in or should live in. And I think, as Peter was suggesting, you know, King Charles, he's an idiot. I mean, he is the biggest joke in, you know, British royal history, perhaps. And he hasn't even gotten to, you know, his chance at the plate. or at the wicket or whatever they fucking do in cricket. And he is going to whiff so badly. I think in a couple of weeks we'll see Johnny, you know, Johnny Lydon shake off the tears, you know, and stop being Andrew Sullivan and being Johnny Rotten.
That's very good. All right. There's actual policy to discuss as well. Last week, the White House held what it called a listening session on tech platform accountability. They're not even trying anymore, are they? They're just like, let's go to the creepy machine. Get the creepy lingo. Anyways, at the end of it, the Biden administration spelled out its six principles for enhancing competition and tech platform accountability. Peter, what the hell is in there and why should we hate it?
The main takeaway from all of this is that the White House doesn't understand big tech and has some truly awful plans to regulate it, some of which have been around before, but that the White House is also planning to run on this. The timing here really tells you a lot. This is not just that they're releasing this because there's some sort of, you know, legislative deal coming up. They are releasing this now because they want to run on this, at least in this year's midterms and probably going into the 2024 election. So the listening session that you mentioned mainly turned out to be a forum for misinformed gripes about how big tech is ruining America. There was no transcript released, but there was a readout, which is basically an official summary, and it led with this. The rise of tech platforms has introduced new and difficult challenges, from the tragic acts of violence linked to toxic online cultures, to deteriorating mental health and well-being, to basic rights of Americans and communities worldwide suffering from the rise of tech platforms big and small. Right, that warms Catherine's heart, right? She she hears that sort of thing and she's just like, yes, these people are trying to help. People are unhappy and it's all big tech's fault. And that's, I think, if you want to boil this down to a single message, it's people are unhappy and don't blame government, blame big tech. So the principles included, there were principles for enhancing competition and tech platform accountability. And it basically amounts to, we want to use antitrust to punish big tech and companies and big tech companies for being too big. We're going to fear monger about kids and online child safety. And we want to eliminate Section 230 liability protections for tech platforms. So the Section 230 thing, again, is not entirely new. Biden has been talking about this for at least a couple of years, but it is predicated on a fundamental misunderstanding of what Section 230's liability protections do, which is that they ensure that website owners and hosts in most cases are not liable for material that someone else posts on their site. So everybody thinks this is about like hate speech being posted on Facebook, but it's also about comment sections on the New York Times. Or comment sections in your personal Substack. What it means is that people who write online and who produce things online, if they have some sort of forum where people can communicate with each other, the person who owns that platform or who manages it isn't responsible when some Yahoo shows up and posts something awful or nasty or illegal. And it's just like, that's a good thing to have because that facilitates communication. It means that the web can be an open forum where people can talk. And it also particularly protects those platform owners and managers if they do moderation. Because this has been one of the concerns is that, you know, oh, well, look, if they're moderating, that means that they're much more like it's more like an editorial product because they're making decisions. And Section 230 says, no, even if you're doing some moderation, you're still not liable. And so it's at least plausible that if you got rid of these Section 230 protections that exist right now, you would end up with a world in which there is less moderation because companies that own comment forums would say, well, look, if we're getting in there and making decisions about, you know, what content is okay and what content is not, then that makes us liable for it. And so it's very bad, and it shows a real misunderstanding of both the law and how big tech works.
Nick, you covered not just Section 230, but the Communications Decency Act from which it sprang back in the mid-90s. At this point, what do you attribute the constant misreading and invoking of Section 230? Is this like extended ignorance, or is this more opportunism? They know that people have these ideas about it that are wrong, and they're going to use it to try to get what they want, which is to curtail speech that they don't like.
Yeah, I think that people who are pushing for an end to Section 230 are confused and generally wrong. They don't remember or understand the law. They think it only applies to certain, to big tech companies. And actually, in the White House's talking points about this, which you can find on the White House website, they say, you know, large tech platforms have special rights that somehow don't, you know, and they imply it doesn't accrue to smaller ones, which is just flatly wrong. They want to get rid of Section 230 because Section 230 is the thing that opened up the internet for wide-ranging speech and user-generated content, which is the, you know, this is why Section 230, you know, is the 26 words that invented the internet or created the internet, that type of thing. It allowed virtually everything that we take for granted on the internet. And people want to control that. I see this more, and, you know, we've been talking about this at Reason for years now, but going back to 2018, what this is really about, it's analogous to the end of the open railroad baron era, where railroads recognized that their profits were declining, and they went to the government at the same time that progressives were saying, we need to regulate the railroads and profits. And what you have here, I think, is a convergence of industry, of dying industry players, first and foremost, Facebook or Meta, and regulators having a common agenda, which is they want to control the marketplace as it exists now. For slightly different reasons, but it's to the same end. And that is what is, that's what's happening here. And in a way, that's why arguments about, no, Section 230 actually doesn't give anybody special, right? It gives everybody equal access, is not necessarily going to get the job done. Because that's the argument here is that industry and regulators want to control speech at a time when it's kind of popular to say, you know what, we need to protect speech and privacy. And
it's not just
that.
Section 230. It's also an obsession with algorithms. And so two of the 6 points on the White House's guidelines list dealt with algorithms. Increase transparency about platform algorithms and content moderation decisions. Stop discriminatory algorithmic decision making. The obsession with algorithms, with like...
just the word.
Is just like, bizarre. Algorithms are sorting mechanisms. We have a great feature coming up in a couple of months on this. I don't want to give too much away, but it's just, it's a complete misunderstanding of how these systems work, why they're implemented. What algorithms basically do is they help us sort through mass amounts of information. And they're there. And sometimes they're going to be annoying. Sometimes algorithms are going to produce results that may not be the ideal one that you want right now. At the same time, they're getting better. And overall, what they do is they help us sort of get through the massive amounts of information that are available on the web, on social media, on Netflix, also on, you know, on Hulu and, you know, on Spotify, on anything where there's just a ton of content and there's, you know, you could make a million different choices. What algorithms do is they help serve to you the thing that you are most likely to want.
I just want there to be a little shift key, control key thing, maybe an algorithm, whereby every time you encounter the word algorithm in the wild, you get a little animated GIF of Al Gore dancing. Can we do that?
Al Gore. Oh,
like the dancing baby.
Exactly.
From the 90s.
Exactly.
Clippy. Yeah. Did you
in
mean
a tan
Al Gore?
Suit.
Yeah.
Peanut butter jelly time. Oof.
It is, you know, it's important to note that this is happening because the internet, like the legacy industries in the internet are, you know, want it. I mean, Facebook, Meta in particular, has been running ads about how much things have changed since 1996, and we haven't really changed the regulation of the internet. We want to do that. In 2018, Mark Zuckerberg said, it's time to regulate, and we want to help you write those regulations. Like, this is a very old playbook that happens when industries, when the leaders in industries start going soft. There is all sorts of stuff busting out on the internet. So the idea, you know, because antitrust is the other thing, you know, along with algorithms that they're constantly stressing. And again, there's a consensus because a bunch of right wingers and a bunch of left wingers are harping on, you know, monopolies online. which is what makes it so dangerous. But this is not because they're describing reality. It's they are, you know, this is battening down the hatches where regulators and industry get what they want, and the rest of us will suffer.
Catherine Slade, Stephanie Slade, was at the National Conservatism Conference, NatCon, over the weekend. It sounds like fascinating speeches by Peter Thiel and Blake Masters. It's they don't like Section 230 either. They want the antitrust as well. How are you feeling right now, Catherine, about where free speech in technology are in the political culture?
Super lonely, my guy. Just really sad and lonely. I think that there's a clear thing going on where and we see this in concrete instances as well as a general theory. Both the left and the right are pretty sure that they can figure out how to fix speech on the internet, but they have very different plans, and they're just going to do them at the same time and pretend they're the same plan. So, for instance, after the Dobbs leak, both Democrats and Republicans introduced rules to determine what people would find when they searched for information about abortion on Google. Both parties tried to tell Google that if they didn't show the information that those parties wanted about abortion, they would be doing the disinformation and therefore in trouble. We can't do this with everything. We can't do this with all the things. And that is absolutely what we are gearing up to do. And I think that actually the big tech companies have made a little bit of a mistake in that they are trying to have it both ways when the dreaded algorithms come up. So they both want to say, well, listen, we built these algorithms and it's nothing personal. When, you know, when your stuff gets banned, it's not you. It's just the algorithm. We didn't choose that. But also, algorithms are not terrifying, Asimovian, out of control computer programs. They are under the control of people and they are just the rules we make for ourselves. And you can't actually have both of those things be true, even if they are at discrete moments. And that is going to be where the wiggle room is that the politicians sneak in.
Can I just say how happy it makes me that you just tossed off the word Asimovian?
I'm here for you guys.
She also decapitative earlier. So she's
I'm trying
Catherine's
to get the best score on the SAT that I can get on this podcast and in life. Nick, you're
all
fucked
right
up again, probably. Say something.
Oh, he is. It's not, there's right. No question about that.
I can't hear him.
All right. We're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, look, we're all responsible adults here. We do what it takes to ensure our families in case of a medical emergency. But what many of us don't realize is that health insurance won't always cover the full cost of an emergency medical flight. Even comprehensive coverage can leave you with high deductibles and copays. That is where Air Medcare Network comes in. When you sign up to become a member, should any such emergency arise, you will not see a bill for air medical transport when flown by an AMCN provider. Air Medcare flying machines transport more than 100,000 patients each year. Best of all, this peace of mind for your whole family can be yours, beginning at the low, low price of just $85 a year. But wait, listeners to the Roundtable can get gift cards with their new memberships for up to $50 American through either Visa or Amazon gift cards, right? Simply visit airmedcarenetwork.com/reason, use the offer code REASON, and start protecting your family. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, reminder, please email your succinct queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one, edited for length, comes from Rob Brooking, who writes, "Hello, Roundtable. I see the Forward Party as planting the seeds for blossoming of a multi-party democracy. As the initial priority of achieving ranked choice voting state by state is laid out, Forward Party is essentially the third party for third parties. As the saying goes, may 1,000 third parties bloom. Think of an alliance for a ranked choice voting." That's not hard. It's hard for me to say. "Policy coalition with other third parties, namely with the other two largest third parties, Libertarian and Green. This opens up a very interesting dynamic of politics, and particularly centrism. No longer is centrism on a binary scale of red or blue, where the center merely takes a little from the left and a little from the right, what is called the mushy middle. Ultimately, should some sort of coalition of libertarians, small and large L, libertarian adjacents, libertarians, and classical liberals join the Forward Party to launch it towards the future. Catherine, you're a hashtag never voter, obviously, but do you think that people who largely agree with your policy views should give at least some emotional support to the Yang Gang?
If they want, I guess. I mean, I respect that there's this constant effort to try and do a thing that might help with our politics. I do, but I doubt this is going to be it. And that is not a surprise for me. I don't think anyone who's ever listened to this podcast before is like, gee, I wonder if Catherine thinks we should join the Forward Party and vote. But I do want to cite a tweet from Mr. Joe Hunter that really kind of captured, I think, a lot of people's feelings. I suspect I'm not alone in feeling like the guy who gave someone some new clothes, a new car, and a little cash, only to have the clothes traded for a clown suit, the car wrecked, and the cash pissed away on a weekend bender. This was about the LP. But it's going to be about the Forward Party, too. And the Green Party. And whatever else. It's not going to work, and everyone's going to be in a clown suit in the end.
Wow.
Sorry.
No, I was just getting excited about my clown suit.
You'll look great in a clown suit. You already are in libertarian magician chic sometimes, and it's just one step to clown suit from there.
I just want to be the underwater clown. What was it? A Glurgle or something like that?
What?
Nick, you sound like someone who's hissing on a microphone far away. What do you tell our forward-looking enthusiasts?
I'm not a fan of the idea of joining the Forward Party, and I'm also increasingly not a fan of ranked choice voting or any other kind of voting scheme, because these things always end up having the effect, and things like open primaries or the top two go on to, you know, the final, like in California and things like that. They actually have the effect of diluting and erasing third parties. The Libertarian Party in many elections at the state level, at the local level, and even at the presidential level, increasingly are capable of covering the spread or making a serious dent into that. And I actually think from a libertarian perspective, and, you know, I want libertarian policies implemented, and I want the Libertarian Party to grow to a point where one or both of the two parties will start to, you know, kind of use libertarian policy approaches to try and win the libertarian vote, whether it is 3% or 5% or 10% of the electorate. So I would rather see that than whatever the Forward Party is, which is not at all clear. And it's also, you know, many of its basic policy prescriptions are not in any way, shape, or form, you know, particularly palatable from a libertarian, from a small government, deregulation, individual autonomy perspective.
I think the top two in particular of electoral reforms is kind of explicitly anti-third party. It was sort of sold like very, very half-heartedly as being helpful for political pluralism, and it's not. It's just a way to make California even more of a one-party state, more than anything else. Peter, how do you look?
I mean, Nazi Germany had, you know, more of a spread. You know,
hey there, Godwin. How's it going?
Legislature.
I mean, didn't you kind of Godwin earlier, Peter? You're from Florida. What do you make of this?
I appreciate Andrew Yang's shout outs to libertarians. His willingness to kind of engage with people who call themselves libertarians, and his willingness to engage with libertarian ideas. I think his openness to different forms of politics and political arrangements is valuable, right? We need experimentation and entrepreneurship in politics. And even if Yang can sometimes seem sort of silly or frivolous, even if, you know, his experiments don't pay off, I'm glad they are happening. But I think Catherine is totally right about how this particular experiment is going to play out. And as I've said, I don't do political parties. I do cocktail parties. I political parties aren't for me. I prefer ad hoc policy coalitions to advance good policy and good ideas. This is not that.
I would add, as I have been saying a lot from since about 2015, certainly, but much more strenuously since 2017 and 2018, times of negative polarization are deadly for independent and third party candidates. When people are motivated to vote because they're scared, witless by what the other team is going to do once in power, whether it is in terms of policy or individual corruption or authoritarianism or whatever, then there's not going to be a lot of patience for people who are like, yeah, but both sides have problems and we're getting people of all stripes. No, those are the most hated people in contemporary politics. I wrote probably three or four pieces during the first or in the only Trump administration about how Jeff Flake is the most hated man in politics. He got mad at me, I think, at some point. He's like, they don't hate me that much. And it's like, using you as an example, an exemplar here. But it's that type of kind of, you know, public spirited, do-gooder, emotional centrism, not even like policy centrism, that people just are brutal towards. So while I am always happy to see new entrants come in and start doing the very hard, sloggy work of building a party from scratch, and I hope that everyone in those parties comes together on trying to open up the process to third parties and independent candidates, which have a lot of roadblocks that are constructed by the Democratic and Republican parties. There isn't a huge market as politics stands right now for that type of third party building politics. So I'm always happy to be shown wrong or shown otherwise, but you're not going to go broke betting under the spread of where you think a third party is going to go. All right, we're going to do a lightning round of one to one person here as we get towards the end here. Most families, mine included, are trundling back to school this month. There have been a rash of studies, articles, political arguments about what an absolute horrid disaster COVID-related school closures have inflicted on the learning of K-12 students. White House Press Secretary Karen Jean-Pierre earlier this month reacted to coverage of these studies that have come out by blaming Republicans for keeping schools closed and crediting Democrats for opening them up. So, Catherine, as the stand-in mother of on this podcast, and as you start your school year, what has you more stabby? This type of gaslighting when talking about the school closures or whatever last vestiges of COVID restrictions are still clinging to life in the fall of 2022.
My school choice privilege is definitely showing here when I say that I'm now stabby about the gaslighting and the rhetoric rather than the actual impact on my life. This is because, as we've discussed on this podcast, I, like other the highly educated, urban-based, rich people have school choice. And so I opted my kids out of the public system a while back. And that means that COVID restrictions basically don't affect me. They do, however, affect millions of children in this country. And it is absolutely infuriating that these same entities that said stuff like, your kids don't know multiplication tables, but at least they are resilient, and also, well, do you want them to learn or do you want them to live, are now somehow pretending that they weren't the problem. They are the problem. They were the problem. They will continue to be the problem. There is no way around this. And while I look upon the declining enrollment figures for major public systems with glee, I recognize that those are not actually good news because they represent families who had to bail out and hope their parachutes would work. And that is not how it should have to go.
One of the worst things right now in American public policy and life is that schools that are financed under the head or funded by the Head Start program, so preschools, so three-year-olds, they have to wear masks. We're still masking three-year-olds. We should stop masking three-year-olds. We're not even masking people in the New York subway anymore, which is a day I thought I'd never see happen. But the governor of New York, who obviously runs the subways in the city of New York, announced that last week. So it's ridiculous what we continue to do to children, and that there are any of these things left is an absolute disgrace and a sign that there are whole swaths of people who refuse to learn even the most basic lessons of the stuff that they got so disastrously wrong And it's going to blow up a lot of things for a long time, is my prediction ongoing.
And okay. The other thing we should say just about Head Start very quickly is that Head Start serves some of the poorest kids and families in the country. And it is just wild and bizarre that we have spent the last several years talking about, you know, disparate impacts on minorities, on, you know, on black kids, on poor families. And then we have lingering COVID policies that by far affect poor families, black families, much, much more than, say, Catherine's family, because Catherine can buy her way out of the system, and many of these folks can't. They're stuck in programs like Head Start, and they're stuck with these rules that are clearly having a disparate impact on people, you know, on people who have less means.
We still have in New York City K-12 system a vaccine requirement for anyone who wishes to engage in extracurricular activity such as sports. So I wonder who's playing sports in the New York City public K-12 system, and who is now no longer able to do that. But it's not as if we would want, 16-year-olds to have some extracurricular activity to have right now. It's all very crazy making. Okay, we are going to get to our end of podcast cultural recommendations. Nick, why don't you lead us off? What have you been consuming?
Consumption is a preview of a three-part documentary series by Ken Burns, Lynn Novick, and Sarah Botstein called The U.S. and the Holocaust. It's airing this Friday or debuting this Friday on PBS. It's a fantastic, deep and dark look at the run-up to the Holocaust and the way the United States, both as a society but especially as a government, responded to increasing reports of violence and harassment of Jews. And then even during World War II, when the Final Solution was implemented in 1942, we effectively kept our borders closed for a complex set of reasons, which include terrible immigration policies that were implemented in the 20s, a kind of a lack of credibility in the media that had trafficked in false atrocity stories during World War I, during a particularly awful period, anti-Semitism, particularly in Franklin Roosevelt's State Department, that is unbelievable to like face up to. It is a really rich, disturbing story that has real resonance for how we talk about things today, particularly about immigrants. It's a powerful, powerful documentary series. We have an interview with Ken Burns and Lynn Novick that'll be coming out later this week that kind of previews it. But, fantastic. Yeah, it's terrible to say, this is a fantastic series. It recovers an understanding of American society that really doesn't get enough attention. And it has direct relevance to the way that we talk about things, particularly refugees, but also immigration and kind of national identity in a very profound and provocative way.
Catherine, what have you been consuming?
I read a book that comes out tomorrow called What If 2? Additional Serious Scientific Answers to Absurd Hypothetical Questions. It's by Randall Monroe, who you know as the author of XKCD. He is just a really delightful figure. I have this sense that he's going slightly out of fashion, and I'm bummed about that because he does these sort of little stick figures explaining to each other weird things about science and social science and human behavior and how computers work. And I, for one, find him delightful. This book depicts on the cover the interesting question of what would happen if a T-Rex tried to ride on a jet. That's the kind of thing that's in this book. I am reading it with my almost 9-year-old son because he is the kind of kid who likes to answer the question, can you drink a cloud? And I now know the answer to it, and you would too if you read.
Wait, what's the answer? Because I want to put a cloud in a cocktail.
What If 2 by Randall Monroe. I'm not going to tell you. You got to read the book.
That's dastardly. Peter, what have you been consuming?
I watched the movie Barbarian. It is about the Airbnb from hell. It's an excellent, twisty, quite surprising little horror film. I would say go, if you're going to see this, don't read any reviews first. Don't do anything other than watch the teaser or trailer. I'm not going to tell you too much about it because this is the rare movie where you feel like, on the one hand, the writer-director is in total control, and on the other hand, you have absolutely no idea where the hell this thing is going. And so it is just, it's just a kind of remarkable experience that I don't have very often, where I either feel like they don't know what they're doing and this movie is going to go off the rails, or I feel like, oh, we basically understand how this movie has been put together and we have a rough sense of where it's going. And that sense of what the hell is going on here? How is this all going to come together and be wrapped up? Is just like, it's just perfect. It's kind of remarkable. It's super effective. It's also a nice little bit of the movie twists the idea of social trust that like the sharing economy and Airbnb and services like that are built on, because it basically sort of says, well, look, we have all these systems that rely on you trusting strangers that you know nothing about. You don't know anything about this house, its history, its owner, the property management company that may be in the middle of it. You have no idea, right? And then, you know, and from our perspective as libertarians, that's like the beauty of capitalism, is that markets make those sorts of transactions possible. But what this movie sort of says is, well, what if that trust broke down in the most spectacular and horrific way? It's great. It's terrifying. It's actually also quite funny. And for people who are somewhat sensitive to these sorts of things, it's gory at times, but I would not say it's remarkably gory. This is not like a splatter picture. This is one that's designed to just make you go, oh my God, what is happening here? And it works very well.
So I watched... I thought I had my my crying on airplanes thing licked. I thought I'd beat it. I watched four movies that I'd never seen in their entirety before, and they were as follows. This is in order of my preference of them: 3 Days of the Condor, thumbs up.
Great.
Speed, really good movie.
Wow,
they were right about that. The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent.
It's okay.
And Enemy of the State. So I watched all four of those, and the only time I even like choked up a tiny little bit was obviously at the end of The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, which is an emotional movie, when they play the Warren Zevon song. Come on, you're not going to, it's going to be hard to deal with. But anyways, I thought I had it all beat, and I'll probably talk about those movies later. But then I watched the fifth movie on the flight, and I'm here to tell you that that's some of the worst ugly crying that any human plane has ever had to witness. It was just like face spasms. I watched a documentary from last year called Brian Wilson, Long Promised Road. A lot of the spasmodic sobbing has more to do with my own personal problems, to be clear. But also, it's, I don't know if I'm recommending it here, people. I love the Beach Boys, love Brian Wilson's compositions and his contributions to the arts. And there are moments of incredible, like, post-verbal transcendence here. There's a moment where Don Was, the record producer who actually produced his own documentary about Brian Wilson in 1995, which I haven't seen. I should go cry that one out too. But he's like sitting at the board, the mixing board, and isolating various bits of God Only Knows, classic, arguably the best Beach Boys song, and sort of like listening to it and trying to figure it out. And he can't, he can't do anything. There's no words that can come out of, and like, so I'm happy with that. But this is another one of the many times mentioned on this podcast executive producer problem. Two of the executive producers are Brian and Melinda Wilson, husband and wife. This is so that obviously leads to a very kind of hived off what we're going to present and what we're going to not. And also, the dudes had like serious, like savage mental illness for a half century now, and we just sort of sit and watch it. He drives around a car with a journalist from Rolling Stone named Jason Fine, and he's just like, oh, I don't want to drive over there, I'm scared. He talks about how what he hears, this is actually one of my favorite bits, when he heard or hears even now the Doobie Brothers song What a Fool Believes, he's just too frightened for words. And it feels like I don't need to see a mentally ill man like exploited once again, even if he's exploiting himself in this case, which he kind of is. It's really uncomfortable making. And it's also like it's not the most thrilling of like footages to basically see a guy just driving him around, and you're looking like at the, it's like, you know, two dudes in cars with coffee show or whatever. You're just watching people drive and going through like his house in Hawthorne and other bits. So music is obviously beautiful. Bruce Springsteen is the most I've liked him in like 35 years. His comments were really perceptive about what makes and made the Beach Boys and Brian Wilson's compositions great. But I'm not sure we needed another documentary about Brian Wilson unless it was different than this. And at some point, like, gosh, he's just having a hard time out there. And it's kind of weird to again and again and again watch him kind of struggle through it. So if you're a Beach Boys fan and a completist, go for it. Just know what you're getting into. And certainly do not watch it on the plane unless you cathartically need to have your eyeballs emptied. It's a Brian Wilson, Long Promised Road, 2021, directed by Brent Wilson. No relation, but he might as well could have been the end. Okay, that's all the time that we have here on the Reason Roundtable podcast. Go to all of our podcasts at reason.com/podcasts. Simple enough. And also, if you like what we do as an organization, the Reason Foundation, it's 501c3, donate to that thing, man. Help us do more of this. Go to reason.com/donate. All right, we will see you next week. Goodbye.